The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, entitled The Baal Teshuvah, The Life and Times of Reish Lakish, is dedicated to the honor and merit of Mr. and Mrs. Gabriel and Renee Vodnai.
One of the most fundamental principles of Judaism is the principle of free will, Bechira Chofshis. Even though God controls the world, as we say, in Scripture, Ein Od Milvado, there's nothing else besides God, there's no other power. But he lets us, in a certain sense, he steps back and lets us exercise our own free will. And we have the power to change the direction of our lives, to mold ourselves into a form that we choose. The idea of free will is not just once in a lifetime or several times in a lifetime. Virtually every moment of our life, we are exercising our will. Sometimes we make the right decisions. Very often, we don't. But inherent in the process of free will is the possibility of tshuva, of repentance. We can make wrong decisions, we can turn around and right our life. As Reish Lakish, the great teacher of the Talmud, put it, Habo l'taher misayinoso. A person who has the desire to purify himself will receive help from above. And probably the greatest example of someone who put this principle into action was Reish Lakish himself. Although a descendant of a prestigious family, Reish Lakish left the traditions of his forefathers and became the head of a band of armed robbers. Yet, he was able to make a complete transformation and become one of the greatest teachers in Israel. His story is the subject of tonight's lecture. To understand how far a person has fallen, one has to understand a person's beginnings. In modern parlance, we generally call someone a Baal Teshuva, who comes from an environment and from educational circumstances that generally didn't allow the person to become much more than what he developed into. And the tshuva that such a person does, the repentance, is really, one is repenting, one feels bad for lost opportunities, but there's a minimum of culpability of one's actions before, because after all, most of the people that are often called, again, today's parlance, a Baal Teshuva, are really Tinoka Shenishbu. The term Tinoka Shenishbu is a Jewish child that was captured and raised amongst non-Jews, who never knew any better. And for the most part, what we would call a Baal Teshuva today, our people have really a minimal culpability, minimal responsibility of what they did previous in their lives. They were offered choices later in life, and they seized the opportunity. The Baal Teshuva, in the classical sense, though, is someone who did have the benefit of an education, who knew better, was in all probability raised to a high degree of knowledge and observance, and to one level or another left it. And that really is the case of the subject of tonight's lecture, Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish, we have in the notes, It seems from a Gemara in Shabbos in Kufyutes on the Beis in 119b, the Reish Lakish was once speaking to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasiyah. This is a descendant of the famed Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the editor of the Mishnah. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasiyah, according to one version of the Talmud, was quoting to Reish Lakish a tradition that he had received from Reish Lakish's ancestors. In other words, Reish Lakish came from a prestigious family, a family of teachers of Torah. And it seems that at least at an early age, he was exposed to the great teachers of Torah. Much later in his life, when Reish Lakish already was a great scholar, and someone brought a report of a statement made by Rav, the great sage in Babylon, the subject of a previous lecture. And Reish Lakish looked at Rabbi Yechon and says, "Who's this Rav? Who is this person?" He says, "Don't you remember him?" He says, "He was the famous disciple of Rabbi, of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who served Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and Rabbi Chia. He was on such an intimate basis when he would be with them, he would sit in front of them, almost like a colleague. I, Rabbi Yochanan is saying, was very young then, I just stood up." He says, "But don't you remember him?" And he says, yeah, I remember him. He says, "And I remember he's talk a great person." He says, "Gover Bakuli excelled in everything." But evidently he was there in the yeshiva, Reish Lakish. I don't know to what level he achieved, but at least he was intimate enough, at least who were the great disciples of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. At a later date, he also said, jointly with Rabbi Yochanan, that the impression of just looking at Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the expression is, they saw the fingers protrude from his coat. Just taking a look at him changed our lives. And we merited to grow in Torah because we had that image in front of us. We looked at him. But it's indicative he is someone who knew Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi intimately. It's not clear to what level he had achieved. It seems from historians that he was younger than Rabbi Yochanan. He had not reached the level of Rabbi Yochanan even in his early age. But it seems that he came from a prestigious family, and B, at least at an early age, he was raised as would normally be expected of children from such families. And yet, it seems, he left it all. The source, from page 2, the source of him being a robber is always taken from a Gemara in Bava Metzi, which we're going to speak at length a little later. Later in his life, towards the end of his life, there was a discussion between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish regarding the laws of vessels. According to the Torah, a metal vessel, a metal tool, can receive the laws of tumah, of ritual impurity. But it has to be a finished vessel. A vessel that's in the middle of the manufacturing process is not susceptible to tumah, to this spiritual uncleanliness. But the question is, when is the manufacturing process considered at least minimally complete? And here they're speaking about a sword, a knife, a dagger. These are tools of war. And there was an argument. Rabbi Yochanan said just being in the furnace itself, is after it's taken out of the furnace, at least it's considered minimally complete. It's considered a completed vessel and therefore susceptible to the law, to tumah. Reish Lakish disagreed, and he says it has to be furbished in water. In other words, it has to be put in water afterwards. As a quip, as a remark, Reish Lakish, Rabbi Yochanan replied to him, "I see, the robber, your trade well. I mean, evidently you've been around knives, I see. You really know what it takes." He was quite offended. Reish Lakish. His reply is really the subject of what we're going to speak of a little later. On the simple level, and this seems to be the level that Rabbi Yochanan understood, his reply was, Maya honestly, like, what did it benefit me? You know, now I became a rabbi. Listen, this is Hosam Rabbi Korali, this is Hochag Rabbi Korali. They called me a rabbi, a master then, when I was with the robbers, and they call me a master now. It wasn't a big change. It wasn't a big career change. You know what I mean? It's like the CEO, you go from one company to another. You know? It's really the same skills, you know? We're going to speak about this at length a little later. But this is the source from they derive that he was a robber chieftain. We do not have, though, besides this source, we don't have any details about how he conducted his life as the chief of robbers. What did he rob? What did he do? We do have, though, several incidents that point at least to his daring and his physical strength. One is an amazing incident, which is taken from the Gemara in Gittin Mem Zayin Amud Aleph of 47a. Reish Lakish once sold himself, the language Luludoi, to the Lydians. And there's a question what this means. Rashi explains that Ludoi, the Lydians, and Lydia was a city in Asia Minor, these were cannibals. I guess they ate it as a ritual or whatever, but these people were cannibals. And therefore, really, when he sold himself, really, he sold himself to be killed. And I guess the money would have gone to his family. I mean, there are people who would do this. It'd really be hard up. The other translation is that ludum really refers to gladiators. And in Latin, ludus is the school of gladiators. And this refers to the gladiators, the gladiator. Torial games. So let's in those who went to gladiator school were also sold. In other words, they enlisted them at a certain price, and again the money would go to the families. In this case, it wasn't not necessarily would they die, but there was a very high mortality rate. You know, it's worse than boxing. You know, I mean, it's very few. There were those who lived through a whole career, and there are monuments of these people, but I'm sure that an aging gladiator, the mean age of gladiators was not very high. So he sold himself to these people. He took with him a bag with a stone in it. He hid it. Because they it's a known fact that on the last day, you know, and I guess this is the day that they're going to, according to Gladiator School, I guess when their training is complete and it's the big game, they grant any request of a man in order that they may forgive him for his murder. In other words, you know, really, that was the traditional salute, you know, that the gladiator, we who are about to die, salute you. You know, it reminds me of the story of the on death row, they also have the same thing. The person gives them, that one is allowed to just find what he can eat, you know, anything that he requests. You know, so there are very there are various stories, you know, about this. You know, one story is that the person asked, that was in the winter, and he asked for watermelon, who was his last. So they told him it's out of season. He says, I'll wait. Another story is that the absurdity of this all says another story is that the it was asked what does he want, you know, in this last thing. So he says he wants lettuce and non-fat fat-free cottage cheese. So you ask him why. He says, I'm on a diet. he took this Reish Lakish. This wasn't a matter of food. It was a matter of granting just a request. So he had this little bag with a stone. Evidently it weighed an awful lot. And then he says, what would you like? He says, I want you to let me tie your arms and seat you in a row and give each of you a blow and a half with my, with this, it was a leather, you know, bottle. I mean, it was a leather bag. He says, I just want to give you like a little tap on the thing. You know, everyone has his mishigas, you know, everyone has this thing. Let me do this. He says, okay. So he bound them all up and they're all sitting there. He says, and gave each of them a blow with his bag, you know, which, says, you know, which stunned them, which really killed them. And he says, one of them is as he was being hit on the head, he ground his teeth at him. Are you still laughing? And he gave him another blow as well. And he killed all of them and took back the money that he made for his, you know. he kept the money. What it seems from this story, how amusing it is perhaps a key as to what motivated him to become a robber. The Mishnah in Sota explains that at the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, terrible suffering began. It describes that when Reb Shimon ben Gamliel, his father, died, there was terrible suffering. And when Reb Yehuda Hanossi died, it was twice as much. It was just terrible. And the suffering, of course, was the suffering of Jews at Roman hands. Those who were involved, these Lydians, or similar gladiators, were basically, this was all part of the Roman occupation of Palestine. We know from a previous era, there was a very famous robber. We had touched upon this in a previous lecture, that at the Rabbi Elazar ben Dinai, who was quoted in the Mishnah as a robber, but we know from the Medrash and Shir HaShirim that he was part of the independence movement, and it seems the people that he was robbing were basically those who either were Romans or who threw their lot together with the Romans. It would seem that Elazar ben Dinai was somewhat of a Robin Hood. In other words, that the people that he attacked actually were people that were either involved with the Romans or involved with the Romans, Roman sympathizers, people that he felt were plundering the land. It would seem that he was very... he was very selective as to who he robbed. It would seem, on the same level, if there was this terrible persecution at the time of the death of Yehuda Hanossi, there would be a terrible attraction for those, and especially as a person of his strength, to join those who were active in the opposition. This was not an independence movement at the time of Reish Lakish; that had already been crushed. But at least it was it was their way of A, making a living, and B, making the lives miserable of those who had done so much bad to them. And in that sense, there are historical parallels, even in recent times, of, you know, the partisans of those who fought in the Warsaw Ghetto. There's a time that, at least for some of them, felt there was a time to close the books of the Gemara and to go out and fight. And it could be that Reish Lakish, and again, I'm only theorizing, succumbed to this, would become to the fervor of the times, and it would put in greater context this story over here of killing those of the gladiator school. This was really part of the protest movement. But in the process, of course, he left the yeshiva. To the extent that he forsook Judaism, though, is not clear. There's no mitzvah to be a robber, and what he was is not part of the, you know, the, what and what is expected or what is allowed. But one is reminded of the story of one of the great Hasidic masters, Reb Levi Yitzchak of Bardichev, who once spoke to one of the people who plied this as a trade, even in Europe, as cat burglars. So, and he spoke to one of them, and he asked them, what happens? You go into a home, and there's diamonds, there's gold. He said, I take it. That's my living. What happens if you go Pesach time? Do you steal on Passover? Well, listen, you have to make a living. What happens if you find cake, bread? He says, Rebbe, chas v'sholem. I should go and touch chometz on Pesach. Parnos is one thing. You got to make a living. That's Pesach is Pesach. There's a similar story. This is told over, I believe, says Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who was the Rav of Brisk before World War I. In the year of the middle of World War I, that there was a wedding that was to be performed, and the one who was the host was the daughter of the head of the head of the largest group of Ganovim in Brisk, and there was a question: could they eat at the wedding? This was before the days of. There was recognized rabbinic supervision. Someone invited you, they cooked up the meal, and it was like you're going over to their home. And could they eat? And I believe the Chaim says you could, because basically the person was a Shomer Shabbos, and just kept kashrus. Living is one thing, and it's not to be condoned, and it's wrong. But on the other hand, kashrus is a different issue. In fact, there's a Tosefta which Tosfos quotes in Chulin, in Yud Beis. This is a case if someone's goats were stolen, and then later he found them slaughtered, and one is allowed to eat them, because we assume most people who slaughter know what they're doing. And even though it's a good chance it was from the thief himself who slaughtered it, just because he's a thief doesn't mean he doesn't keep kosher. So it's very hard to know, in the light of this, it's hard to know how low he had sunk. Now, the fact is that he stole, or he held up people, or he killed these, is not necessarily indicative of what his practice, in other levels. One thing is certain, though, when he was involved in this, he was not learning. And much of what he had studied as a child was forgotten. How old he was when this all happened is also not clear. We don't have dates here printed. Perhaps an indication would be the next incident that we have is on page 2, paragraph C. What brought Reish Lakish back? He says, one day Rabbi Yochanan was bathing in the Jordan. Reish Lakish saw him. Evidently he saw, as we said in the last lecture, his face shone. He didn't see him straight. But he saw like the image, and it was a... And he leaped into the Jordan after him. It was not clear because he thought he was a woman, or he thought that maybe he was going to steal from him. It's not clear. But Rabbi Yochanan looked at him, and evidently it seems that they knew each other from childhood. He says, your strength should be for the Torah. What are you doing things like this? So he says, your beauty should be for women. He says, if you'll repent, I'll give you my sister in marriage, who's more beautiful than I. And when he said that, and evidently it would seem from this he was not that far from it, in other words, just for a statement like this to feel that he could be accepted back and to start life anew, he agreed. In fact, and he was at that point, as he did tshuva. He says, he saw that really I mean, one of the major problems that the people face in becoming Balei Tshuva, and again, especially about people who were there once and left it and coming back, is they're not going to be accepted. You know, how could I go? You know, they look at me. When they look at me, they always think about my past. They'll never appreciate me for me. And it's quite possible, says that this was going on in his mind. And Reish Lakish, he came from a prestigious family when he was a young man, knew Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, knew basically what was right, and probably had in all probability had a struggle within himself. I mean, one doesn't just say, I'll give you my sister in marriage, doesn't change a person. And evidently, he was close to it himself. The fact is that he was willing to accept him, you know, was an indication that Rabbi Yochanan himself didn't look at him like someone who was totally, was a total oisrof, you know, was someone who totally could be dismissed. When he came to go out of the Jordan to collect his weapons, he wanted to jump up. He didn't have the strength anymore. He had, you know, his whole mindset had changed. You know, he wasn't the robber anymore. You know, he was much more serious. Huh? And subsequently, Rabbi Yochanan taught him Mikra, you know, the Bible, which evidently he'd forgotten much of what he had learned, and Mishnah, and made him into a great man. Rabbi Yochanan is the one who made Reish Lakish. How old was he at the time? One would assume that he was still a young man. You know. The sister, this is the proof they bring, Rabbi Yochanan, as we brought from a previous lecture, was an orphan. His father had died while his mother was pregnant with him. His mother died at childbirth. The sister must have been either a twin or an older sister. And in all probability, she was probably still a young woman. I mean, she hadn't been married yet or whatever. She's probably still a young woman. That would make Reish Lakish perhaps in his mid-twenties. You know, which would still be, he had left it perhaps, he'd been in this for perhaps some 10 years. Rabbi Yochanan saw in him, says the qualities, that it all was not lost. And it seems even in his later years, the strength that he had, the physical strength, was not lost either. It's on the top of page 3. We have it's a Yerushalmi, it's Yerushalmi and Trumas. Rabbi Isi, was held. This is Rav Asi. This was the famous disciple of Rabbi Yochanan. Was held captive, and he was in grave danger. Rabbi Yonason, another one of the, he was a colleague of Rabbi Yochanan's, perhaps slightly older, said, you know, knowing the kinds of people that held Rabbi Isi in captivity, he'll probably be killed. His body will be fated to be wound in shrouds. You know, that was the expression. It's like we have to prepare the shrouds for him. Reish Lakish says, I'm not going to leave it. Either I'll kill the criminals or I'll get killed. Says, I'm going to. Says, I'm not going to leave this. And they just can't do this. And he got up and he went to them. Fortunately, he didn't have to use any force. And he spoke to them and appeased them, and says, and they gave Rav Asi back to Reish Lakish, and he said to him, you know, says, he told the whole group, says, why don't you, never they were Jews, says, why don't you go to the elder rabbi and he'll pray for you. So he got that whole group of bandits to go to Rabbi Yochanan. This is Reish Lakish's Rebbe. They came to Rabbi Yochanan and they said, go to the elder rabbi. And evidently Rabbi Yochanan already was an elderly person. Reish Lakish, it seems, was much the same age, maybe perhaps a few years younger. And he still had it in him to go to this lair of bandits. They came to Rabbi Yechon, and Rabbi Yechon wasn't about to give them any brachas. He said to them, what you wanted to do to him, referring to Rav Asi, should be done to you. And before they reached this place, Apipasros, they were all killed. Evidently, Rabbi Yechon and son, Reish Lakish, not someone of just brute strength, but a brilliant, brilliant person. And in fact, later in the Talmud, when they want to refer to people of tremendous intellect, they would refer to Reish Lakish. As Ula said, as one who saw Reish Lakish in the Beis Medrash, was engaged in debate, would think that he's uprooting mountains and grinding them against each other, as if he took this whole massive thing and pulverized it into small pieces. That's how we would analyze. You know, it would seem to be something which defied analysis and defied penetration, and he would divide into its small pieces, small parts. And when Rabbi Yechon, at the end, when Reish Lakish died, Rabbi Yechon, as we said last time, was plunged into deep grief. He says they said, you know, because whenever Rabbi Yechon would give a lecture, Reish Lakish would be the one who would comment on it. Rabbi Elazar ben Pados, who was one of the elder disciples of Rabbi Yechon, was chosen to take the place of Reish Lakish. And when Rabbi Yechon would say his shir, to give his lecture, Rabbi Elazar would go and give 24, it's hyperbole, that he would give 24 supports. You know, he would say, there's a brisa which supports you. In other words, he would show him that, you know, that his statement is really supported from other sources. And he says, in grief, he said, I don't need a yes man. Says Reish Lakish, when I would give a shir, when I would give a lecture, says he would give 24 objections. He would say, but what do you do with this and what do you do with that? And I would be forced to think, you know, to justify my position, and to give novel answers for this problem and that problem. And through the whole process, it led to a fuller comprehension of the Torah. Says, I don't need someone to tell me I'm right. I know I'm right. I need someone to tell me I'm wrong. And this was Reish Lakish. And it was really as of grief for the loss of Reish Lakish that he lost his mind. And the rabbis prayed that he should die because they knew that he couldn't live life without Reish Lakish. And he took his learning very seriously. You think of such a brilliant person, you know, that, you know, everything comes easy. The Gemara in Tainus explains that Reish Lakish, at the bottom of page 3, made his practice to repeat. You know, he's Masada, he would repeat in systematic order his studies 40 times. And then he would come in front of Rabbi Yochanan to discuss it. He learned Torah with an amazing fervor. And this is something we're going to touch upon again, is one wonders about the psychology of a Baal Teshuva. Someone who feels that they've wasted much of their life, who has regrets of decisions they made, and their approach now to their, you know, the fervor that they have, you know, to which they've really embraced. And it would seem that he embodied this. Reish Lakish is the one who taught us the saying, it's quoted, says, Ein divrei Torah miskayim, and this is at the top of page 4, El Misha Mei Misatz Meolel. The words of the Torah are only firmly held someone who kills himself for it. In other words, someone who gives up the pleasures of this world. It's a trade-off. You have to be willing to put hours, then you'll reap the benefits. And he himself has really left no wealth. He was totally just involved in learning. He says he didn't even have a cushion. You know, he didn't have, like, you know, what they has to recline on. At his death, all his material possessions were a kav, that was like a quart of saffron. And he bemoaned that, you know, he left his wealth to others. You know, he didn't use it in his own lifetime. But he didn't accumulate wealth. He wasn't interested in wealth. Perhaps in a previous thing when he was a robber, like, wealth meant a lot to him. But in the process of rejecting, you know, what he had done before. It's quite like that he in others we don't. In other words, it's only of Reish Lakish do we have this statement. You know, there are many great sages, as Rabbi Yechon, and even Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Yechon, Rabbi Loza, Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Asa, Rabbi Bo. We don't find this statement. The attitude to this world, this rejection of this world, is probably part of the whole process. You know, he didn't feel comfortable in this world, unless he rejected it, because he saw what it led him to. It would be akin, you know, those who are alcoholics, and reject, you know, the life that they had led, are not called, says, recovered alcoholics. They're in recovery. It's a process. In fact, they can never touch alcohol again. Because there's this fear that once you start just a little bit, you're back. And it's quite possible. You know, I'm only saying this because it's Reish Lakish's statement. There are other great Gedolim. This is Amoraim of his time, but we don't find a parallel to this. Because in a sense, he looked at it as like alcohol. He didn't want to have anything of that. It was part of the rejection of that previous life. And perhaps with that we could better understand, again, Reish Lakish is the author of the next statement. Shimon ben Lakish stated they found written in a scroll. It was because there's a Megillas Hasidim. It was kept by the scrupulously pious. If you forsake me, says, if you forsake me for one day, says, Yomayim Ezvekam. Says, I'm going to forsake you for two. Because if you stop learning for one day, when you come back the next day, it isn't like you left one day. It's like two have gone. Because as he explains, says that you, it isn't just you've lost that day in time. But the fact is you didn't learn that day. He says you're out of it already. It'll take you another day to get into it. And then he said, this is an example of two people that meet, you know, and cross paths. He says, after a day's journey, they're 2 days apart. And says, they go here and then they cross their paths. Now they're 2 days, not just 1 day apart. When you leave learning, it isn't just you've lost that day. You're out of it already. And perhaps Reish Lakish himself could say it about himself. A person who came from a prestigious family. He had evidently had been by the greats at an early age, and yet Rabbi Yechon had to teach him scripture. Rabbi Yechon had to teach him Mishnah. Scripture is taught when a child is 5 years old. Mishnah is taught when the child is 10, at least, and that was the system that was prevalent at the time. But he himself probably could say, says, this is because of those years that he had spent, says, looking back, says he himself could say this. And again, he authored it on the basis of what he found Megillas Chassidim. But it's just very interesting that, again, he is the one who taught us this. Evidently, it meant a lot to him. It was something that was important for him to impart to his disciples. When he was taken back by Rabbi Yochanan, and evidently Rabbi Yochanan taught him Mikra and Mishnah, he just didn't stop. But by Rabbi Yochanan, the elders of the generation, the disciples of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, were still alive. Rabbi Yochanan, at that point, it seems, was not the Godel Hador, was not the greatest of his generation. He was a rising star, and when he had reached reached a certain level of proficiency, it seems he went to study at the feet of the greats of that generation. And the fact is that he was, and we find him, says, together with Rabbi Ephes, who was the Rosh Yeshiva after Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi died. We find him with Rabbi Hanina on page 5. We find him with Rabbi Yoshia. These were all the Talmidim of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And it would seem, again, assuming that he became a robber right after the death of Yehuda Hanasi, he came back when he was still in his, perhaps in his mid-20s, early 30s. These people were still alive. He studied under Rabbi Yochanan, and then he went on to study, this is by the feet of the masters of that generation. But he grew so great that in a certain sense, he was Rabbi Yochanan's equal. Rabbi Yochanan said of him, discussing the fact that he had disagreed, or Rish Lakish had disagreed with him. He says, "What can I do?" Rabbi Yochanan said, referring to Rish Lakish. He says, "Kenegdi cholok alai," like it's a colleague, one of equal standing, disagrees with me. I don't look at him as a Talmud anymore. It's not just a student. And he had, it seems, a special position in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yochanan. And again, we can't, we don't have the exact dates, but just to give you a sense of how old he was, and let me just quote, I didn't hand out timelines in this lecture, because for the most part we don't use it, but let me just quote something of the timeline of last lecture. Rabbi Yochanan, it seems, was born approximately the year of 176 of the Common Era. Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi died in the year 192. At the end, it's really, it seems towards the end of the year 192. That would make Rabbi Yochanan approximately 16 or 17 years old. It's not clear, again, we don't have an exact of how old Rish Lakish was, but assuming that he was about the same age, perhaps he was 14, 13, 15. When Rav died in the year 247. That would make, says Rabbi Yochanan, says a 71. That would make Rish Lakish a few years younger. While Rav was still alive, and it would seem, though, that at that point, this is Rabbi Yochanan, was the Rosh Yeshiva, the greatest of the generation, one of the disciples of Rav murdered an informer. This is someone who wanted to inform against a Jew to the Persian authorities. He killed him. This is Rav Kahana. And Rav suggested and told him that he has to leave. In other words, the Persians are going to prosecute the case. He has to flee to Israel. He told him, go to Rabbi Yochanan. But he told him, but during the interim, for 7 years, I don't want you to ask any questions of him. Some explain this was part of the penance. I mean, he had actually killed a man. Perhaps he could have avoided killing the informer by stopping the process. But whatever it was, it seems that he was told that part of his penance was don't ask him any questions. When Rav Kahana came to Tveria, to the yeshiva of Rabbi Yochanan, he first asked, where's Rish Lakish? He had heard of him. His fame had spread. Rish Lakish's fame had already spread to Babylon. When he came, says he found Rish Lakish was already giving the Chazoras Hashir. It seems Rish Lakish's position was to repeat the lecture. Notice there was the lecture of the Rosh Yeshiva of Rabbi Yochanan. After the lecture, there was a repetition of that lecture. And then the younger students, I mean, those who were not, on the highest level, would come, probably, and hear the repetition. And again, in the repetition, he would add his own, he would give the explanations, those who had problems with it, and so he came to Rav Kahana came, when he came to the yeshiva, Rish Lakish was in the middle of giving the chazor, of giving the review. So he came in. He says, "Where's Rish Lakish?" He had heard of him. He says, "He's here." He says, "What do you ask?" He says, "Well, I heard, you're speaking about the lecture. You know what you said over here is difficult, and that's difficult, and you raised a question. This could be an answer for that question." So they were—they mentioned this to Rish Lakish, and Rish Lakish told Rabbi Yochanan, "You know what? There's somebody of great stature. Says Arios is all in the bubble. Says a lion has come from Babylon. For some tremendous stature has come. You got to be careful what you say tomorrow." It goes on, of course, to say that Rish Lakish, but when he came, And Rav Kahana sat there, and he put him in the front row. Rav Kahana, because of Rav's suggestion, didn't say anything. So he kept on pushing him back. Until Rav Kahana was put back, like in the seventh row. And it goes on, the Gemara, to explain Rav Kahana felt so humiliated. He says, probably this humiliation is the equivalent of the 7 years of not speaking, and I really have gone through my penance. And he started talking, and they brought him back to the front row. It's a very cute story. But what it does, though, it tells us something about Reish Lakish, that he really had this position. So not only was he his colleague, but he had official position in the yeshiva itself. And as we have on page 6, he had a miturgamon. When he gave his lecture, as was common, the lecture, and it would be a hall packed with people, and this was before a speaker system, what they would do, they would whisper in the ears of the miturgamon, the speaker, so to speak, the translator, who a person blessed with a strong voice and with a gift of the tongue, of the articulate person, would with a booming voice say over the shir. You know. And the Gemara brings on occasion, it shows how articulate Yehuda Bar Nachmeni, the translator, the miturgamon of Reish Lakish, how brilliant he was, as how gifted he was. But this was quite common. You know, it reminds me of a very cute story of a Talmud Chacham, of a Maggid, who would go from city to city and to give lectures. And he had with him his shamash. And the Maggid, or this Rav, was dressed appropriately. He was dressed, his attire beautifully, befitting a man of his scholarship and position. And the shamash looked like a shamash. In other words, the beadle looked like someone who dressed much more plain. And of course, when the great rabbi would come, they would give before the rabbi all the honors, and the shamash would just be treated like a shamash. And the shamash once told the rabbi, says, I go for years, we've been going from city to city. You're afforded all these honors. I don't get anything. Can you do me a favor just once? So let me take the role of the maggid, of the rav, and you be the shamash just this once, please. I want to feel how it really is. He says, okay, but what happens if they ask you questions? He says, I'll take care of it, don't worry. So anyways, he comes in attired, the Rav is the Maggid, and he comes up, and the Rav is the Shamash, dressed like a schlepper, he's dressed like the Shamash. And he comes in, is in front of the Bima, and the throngs of people are there, and he gives this beautiful drosha. And someone over there asks a question he couldn't answer. He was stuck. It was a good question. And he looked at him, and the shamash, the real robe was at his side, dressed like the shamash, and he's there, the imitated imposter's there. And he said, that's a question. Even my shamash can give you an answer. No zogin. Go tell him. One thing we find in the life of Reish Lakish, and again, which shows us, and again, this is the mentality, which I think is indicative of what Reish Lakish had gone through, is his sense of truth, of not compromising the truth, which we find in Reish Lakish. His attitude quite unique. Let me give you a few stories of his life. This is fascinating. We had spoken last lecture about the fact that after the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the prince editor of the Mishnah, His son became the Nasi, became the head of the president of the Sanhedrin. And after death, shortly afterwards, of his sons, his grandson became. All these, his son and grandson, led the Sanhedrin and were people who commanded the respect of all the disciples of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Later on, though, at the death of the grandson of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, his name is Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, his children already did not command that respect. In fact, it seems that his child, Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya's child, did not, Rabbi Gamliel, his son, did not, his reign was short-lived. And the grandson, it would be the great-great-grandson of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, became the head of the Sanhedrin, nominally, and they did not accept him. I mean, that eventually Rabbi Yochanan left, the yeshiva, it was in Tveria, and that became the Sanhedrin, the equivalent, and the Nasi already became just a political figure. He became what would be the equivalent of the president, like in the state of Israel. He had the shtats, he had the thing, the role of the ritualistic thing. He is the head. And he had the sense of prime minister in the sense of the political. But the legislation, the legislative body, the judicial body, was not under his control. His was more of an executive position and more of a ritualistic position. In other words, just like the Queen of England, he's the son, he's the grandson. And it gave the Jewish people that pride. However, when Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya II, in other words, a great-great-grandson, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, came into his position, it wasn't quite defined exactly what his role would be. And he assumed, of course, his role would be that of his ancestors, as the actual leader of the whole Sanhedrin. It seems from historians, early on, though, there were points of stress between the rabbinic leadership and Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya. And one of these points of stress is the following story. Reish Lakish stated that a Nasi who has sinned is flogged in a court of three. In other words, he was a Nasi, he's the head of the Sanhedrin, but if he did a sin which would warrant flogging, he would not be flogged in a court of 23 or 70, in other words, the major courts. It suffice three judges. The question was asked, so after he's flogged, does he return to his position afterwards? Does he become back nothing? And one of the other Gedolim of the time, one of the great scholars, says, he's never returned to that position. Imagine if he got returned to that position of power. The revenge that he would have the whole police force. I mean, he has the old executive power. Says what he would do to the rabbi who commissioned the flogging. This discussion came to the ears of Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya. It wasn't something that he liked, and he sent a troop of soldiers to take Reish Lakish into custody. Reish Lakish escaped. And he went to a tower, a fortified tower or a village. Anyways, Rabbi Yochanan came to the house of the Beis Medrash the next day, and Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya was there as well. This is before he left and had his own yeshiva. So Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya says, why don't you, and he was just sitting there, he didn't start talking. He says, why don't you say something? Like, why don't you start giving a shir? Why don't you do something? So he says, listen. And he said he started to clap with one hand. This is the Zen, the mystery of it. And he started one hand clapping. And he says, well, what's happening? He says, you can't clap with one hand. He says, how can I teach Torah without Reish Lakish here? He says, I can't. So he says, so where is he? So he says, he told him he's in the tower. He says, I'll go together with him and I'll assure him he can get back to the yeshiva. At this point, he was new in the thing. He didn't realize who Reish Lakish was, even. Rabbi Yochanan sent a message, prepare words of Torah, like says, the Nasi is coming to see you. Like, I want you to say something good, floor him. In other words, I want you to impress him. When Reish Lakish came out, he says, So first, you know, so he complimented him. You know, he told him, you're similar to the Creator himself. When he came to release the Jewish people, says he didn't send loyal de malach or de sorah or de shaliach, and as we say in the Haggadah, he didn't send an emissary; he came himself. You came to release me. He says, I'm happy you came by yourself. He says, if you hold me in such regard, says what, you know, what did you say such a thing about the president, the Nasi who sins? He says, what do you think? I'm afraid of you? He says, I'm going to hold back teachings of Torah. He says, like, I'm not afraid of anybody. If that's the Torah, that's the Torah. But that was the attitude of Reish Lakish. You can look at this at the time. It says he was very, his criticism was scathing. So he was on page 7 and 8. One thing is a fascinating thing with him, which the Gemara says in Yoma in Tesalim and Beis in 9b. He says, there's an incident that he spoke to Rabbi Elazar. He was critical. He spoke to Rabbi Elazar and he says that God hates you. You know, Rabbi Elazar was a Babylonian, at least according to. He says you didn't go up. He says when all the Jews, the Babylonians, stayed. You know, in the time of Ezra, when the Beis Hamikdash, when the temple was built, you stayed behind. If all the Jews would have come, it would have been different. You know, Mashiach would have come. Rabbi Yochanan later took issue with that statement of his, but he felt that the tzoras of the Jews are all because the Babylonians didn't come up. So the Gemara critiqued. He says, you know, Rabbi Yochanan could never, Rabbi Shlokesh could have never spoken in the street with Rabbi Elazar. He says because Rabbi Shlokesh didn't speak to anyone in the street. When Rabbi Shlokesh would speak to someone, you knew that person was so reliable. You can give merchandise to that person without witnesses, and you could be assured you'll get your money back. Because he didn't speak, he didn't trust anyone. And evidently, we're speaking, this is Rabbi Elazar, this is Morad Arad Yisrael. He's the master of the land of Israel. He was an incredible scholar, a person of incredible integrity. But his standards were so high that he wouldn't let himself, like, be lowered by social, on a social level. On an intellectual level, they were in the yeshiva together. But on a social level, to meet someone in the street and start schmoozing, and to start talking, he wouldn't lower himself. And it wasn't, it seems, as we're going to say, continue on, it wasn't because he was so critical of the person, he didn't respect the person. And that we have on this, I just wanted to go, this is on page 8 and 9, just to give you an insight of what kind of a person Reish Lakish was. Reish Lakish once delivered a funeral address on the bottom of page 8. There's a Gemara Megillah and Chof Chesem and Beis in 28b. There was a certain rabbinical student who died, who used to repeat halachas. He used to have students, he had 24 rows of disciples, and he used to teach. And he was not a person he was not a person, though, who would give his own insights. He was a person who just taught Mishnah, like halachas or Mishnah. He was a Mishnah teacher. He just taught information. And it wasn't his own, it wasn't his insight, it wasn't on a very deep level. And he said, but when Reish Lakish eulogized the man, as he said, the land of Israel has lost a great man. And he wanted to contrast this attitude with the attitude of Rav Nachman, who was considered a very, in bubbles, he's going to be the subject of one of our lectures, he was one of the saints of Hasidim of Bubble. One of the saints of Babylon. And there was a man who used to repeat not just Mishnah, Sifra, Sifri, Tosefta, he had an encyclopedic grasp of all rabbinic literature. But he was not an analysis. In other words, he did not analyze, he didn't think, he didn't teach the commentaries. but he talked, he had a tremendous grasp of information, greater than the person who died in Israel. And yet, when Rav Nachman was asked to deliver a eulogy, he says he refused. He says, it's just a bag of books that died. It wasn't a person of, you know, could think. Yet, and the Reish Lakish, evidently this person would not be considered a true scholar. But Reish Lakish looked at it as a tremendous loss. And the Gemara uses it to contrast the difference between Babylon and Israel. But in a certain sense, it gives you some what Reish Lakish was. He was a person far inferior to Reish Lakish. He knew Mishnah. He didn't know Sifra, he didn't know Sifri, he didn't know Tosefta. And of course, he didn't know Gemara, he wasn't a master of the Talmud. But yet, says Reish Lakish, felt this was a loss for the Jewish people. There's an incident at the top of page 9. Again, it gives you a sense of, and it's really a lesson for all of us today. Rabbi Abba and Reish Lakish were going to a certain city near Caesarea. Rabbi Abba said to Reish Lakish, what are we going to a city for? He says, who curse and scoff. Evidently, people were not as religious in other areas. So Reish Lakish got off his donkey, took out some vinegar and put it in his mouth. This is like, I don't want to, my mouth is like to become like bittered, you know, I have to get the taste out of my mouth. He says, what was this all about? He says, God does not have any desire in those that speaks as bad about other Jews. He says, you just make me sick. Evidently, the religious level of these Jews speaking about was not, we wouldn't suspect Rabbi Bo made this up. The level of religiosity was not very high. He says, but still, you don't speak bad about Jews. So here we find Reish Lakish, who has a tremendous love and appreciation for Jews and for scholars even on the lowest level. And yet, he would not want to make small talk with a person like Rabbi Elozer. And the question is why? How does one understand this? And again, perhaps, and this is theory, so, but perhaps again, if we give the analysis, you know, of an alcoholic in recovery, Reish Lakish is a person who left much of his, you know, of what he had been taught as a child, made a complete turnaround, embraced the whole Torah. And perhaps was always fearful of backtracking. His level of emes, his midas emes, was beyond the norm. And perhaps he was afraid, he didn't feel comfortable. It was if he would socialize with people, even how great they were, but were a little less than he in terms of emes, in terms of sense of rigor and truth, he was afraid he'd be contaminated. Like there's always this fear. And it's because that he kept it at arm's length. And learning. The Beis Medrash, he's with them in the Beis Medrash. But in terms of meeting them on the street and schmoozing, he was afraid, says, since their level he viewed is slightly less than his, he was afraid of any compromise. He always felt that he was at risk. This is, again, because we find this Mida. In Reish Lakish, we don't find this by others. You know, there are many midas we find, many attributes which go across the board. We find all the great sages have them. This seems to be unique. And perhaps, you know, that his past was something that he had to, this was how he dealt with it. And this is, he made a swing totally to the other thing and kept at it because he was always fearful that if he made a step backwards, he could go back further. It's also very very revealing that Reish Lakish is throughout, you know, the Talmud, he is the teacher of us about the value of tshuva. It's about the value of struggle and tshuva, and he is our teacher regarding this. Which is again amazing that he chose this area. I mean, he speaks about, he's on virtually every page of the Talmud. He speaks on virtually every issue. But still, when it comes to tshuva, to repentance, he is our teacher. There's a very famous quote from him in Brachas and Daf Hei. It says, L'yoylam yargaz olam yetzer tov al yetzer hara. A person should always incite the good impulse to fight against the evil impulse. As a person should always be at struggle. Don't be happy where you're at. Just push yourself. And if you feel you can't go in the struggle, says, let him study Torah. Let him get the inspiration of studying Torah. And if that fails, he says, recite the Kriya Shema. There's the idea of the Kabbalah Soil Malchus Shemayim. V'haftos Hashem Elokecha b'chol levovcha. So you love God with all your heart. Refers b'shnei yitzrecha, with your two impulses. And if that doesn't work, you should remember the day of death. We're here, we're just passing through. But you should constantly push yourself. Rish Lakish is our teacher of this. And he is the, as we began, says, he is our teacher of Habor, says, Imulaitzim hu yolitz. While Novim Yitain Chain, the Posseg in Mishle, so he explains, says, to the scoffers, says Hashem says, lets them, he lets them go. If you want to choose this path, he lets you go. He says, Bo letame poischen lo. A person wants to make himself impure, there are opportunities there. However, Bo letire, once wants to purify himself, says Messiah, so one is helped. One is given a helping hand. It isn't just doors are opened. One is pushed. One is given a helping hand. One is given opportunities. He is the one who taught us as well. Says, and this is part of this notion we have in the davening. You know, says we have this Yod Pshuta L'Kabel Shovim. Says God's hand is out there stretched to receive those who do tshuva. Says, and it's spread out. Says, to shield them from the attribute of justice. It's as if the idea of tshuva is that God sticks out His hand. You know, to take someone who's sinking, who's drowning, and to lift them up. And to save them. And just very apropos that it's Rish Lakish himself who is our teacher. As we described, as we said earlier, his death occurred as a result of an argument between Rabbi Yochanan and himself about the manufacture of tools of war, of weapons. And it says that there's a question is when is the vessel considered finished? Only a finished vessel is susceptible to tumah, to impurity. An unfinished vessel is not. Rabbi Yochanan offers that once it's tempered in the furnace, Rish Lakish countered, says no, says that it's only when it's finished with the water, when it has to be used as furnished in water. Rabbi Yochanan quipped, you know, a robber understands his trade, you know your business well. When what he answered is really is difficult. He says, Maya honestly, like what did you help me, or says, what did you make me better? Which was simple. And Rabbi Yochanan understood this to mean, what do you mean I made you better? He says, I brought you under the tachas kanfei Shechina, under the wings of the Shechina. He says, the H. Yosef, wants to explain that when Rish Lakish said, Maya, honestly, he did not mean, what did you benefit me? But rather, the ahanis really comes from the language of I know. Why are you verbally abusing me? Why are you hurting me? In other words, why do you have to remind me of my past? He didn't mean to, it was definitely interpreted by Rabbi Yochanan to mean that what it, you know, like Rabbi Yochanan thought Rish Lakish meant to say, you know what I mean, it wasn't a big change for me, you know, as I was CEO of Murder Incorporated, and now I'm the head of the yeshiva. You know, it wasn't a big change. It's just a different company. That's how Rabbi Yochanan understood this. But what did Rish Lakish mean? So there are various interpretations, but the one that strikes home As the one offered by the Eitz Yosef, he is one of the commentators on the Ein Yaakov, on the Agadata portions of the Talmud. And he says, like, why are you hurting me? Like from Lashon Ono. You know, there's a halacha that says you're not allowed to tell a Baal Tshuva, someone who's, says, remind him of their past to make them feel ill at ease. Someone is a convert, you're not allowed to remind them of their past in a sense to make them hurt their feelings. You're not allowed to hurt anybody's feelings, period, no matter what context. And he's basically saying, says, what are you hurting my feelings for? Says like this. He says, you know, I mean, and basically saying, look at the change I made in my life. I was in the top of, you know, of a profession, that thing, and I've turned my whole life around, and now I'm the top of, you know, of, I'm a rabbi, I'm a teacher of Torah. Says, why remind me of, why remind me of my, you know, his basic the thrust was, why are you hurting me? Why are you reminding me of my past? He didn't understand it as such. And because of this lack of understanding, there was a tremendous ill will. And Rish Lakish eventually died from it. Cholash Rish Lakish. Rish Lakish died from it. The language or the text of our Talmud is Asoya Chose Kabachya. His sister came to cry. Understood, as we recall before, his sister was offered in hand marriage to Rish Lakish. It's difficult, some have brought things that should be the correct text. Because evidently, says they had, as we'll see, says he had left young children, brilliant children he had left, but they were little pitzalach. I mean, he had left little children. If his sister was as old as Rabbi Yechon and her older, because either was a twin or was an older sister, it would be just physically impossible to have children that late in life. And they want to say that there was a slight error and not achose his sister, but itzase instead of a ches, a tof. That his wife came, as it was not Rabbi Yechonon's sister, but it was another wife that Rish Lakish had. And he asked Rabbi Yechonon to forgive Rish Lakish, to pray for him. He refused because evidently he felt that's what he had misinterpreted. According to Eitz Yosef, he had really misinterpreted that which Rish Lakish had said. Eventually, Rabbi Yechonon and Rish Lakish died. And because of grief, Rabbi Yechon, as we said before, you know, lost his mind. What? It seems the emotion of the thing was such that Rish Lakish had Rish Lakish couldn't forgive Rabbi Yechon for have brought that up, you know, and he didn't really want to talk to him. You know, it wasn't, even though he'd suspect, he felt so hurt because he misinterpreted that thing, he didn't want to speak to him at all. As you say, you can look at yourself, says he had a brilliant child that is brought like more in Tinus and off test. We don't know what became of him eventually, the son, he's not mentioned in a later Amaroyim, but he was a Rish Lakish, it gives you a sense how brilliant Rish Lakish was. He had a brilliant child. One thing, though, it tells us this story, which is perhaps the like the somber note here. We went through the life of Rish Lakish, coming from a distinguished family, having been exposed to the greats of that generation, just as his colleague Rabbi Yochanan had, taking a turn early in his life. Coming back, but that whole experience of leaving and coming back was with him a whole lifetime. It seems to have affected his attitudes, his intolerance of untruth, his fervor of learning, the idea that the tshuva the whole idea of struggle and tshuva was a and dedication was very much a subject that he spoke of and imparted to us. But at the same time, you know, his tragic death tells us an important thing about the way that we deal with people, Balei Tshuva. on one hand, we have Reish Lakish, who rose to eventually virtually every page of the Talmud. This is, you know, has every other page of the Talmud has his sayings. He is very much our teacher to this day. His turnabout, tremendous effect on himself and the Jewish people. But yet, such a person always had that sensitivity. And he eventually lost his life because of this. And it really tells us about the sensitivity we have to have to people that are Balei Tshuva. To realize that their past is something to be brought up only at the discretion of the person themselves. Their privacy and their past has to be kept like in the past. And I noticed Devorim, which is a subject, again, which the Talmud speaks of about verbal abuse, is something which, it's because of the, it would seem, because of a remark said in innocence, that not only two people lost their lives, but the Jewish people themselves were deprived of two brilliant minds. As was said before, was in the last lecture, at the eulogy of Rabbi Yochanan, was compared to a son that said in midday, as he was still active, even though he was in the years, he was still active. And it's a lesson for all of us. Okay, are there any questions? What? No, Lydia over here, I believe, as they say, those who want to explain it, refers to Lydia was a kingdom in Asia Minor. It was in today's Turkey. When they, you know, when they say talk Turkey, you know. Yeah. That Reish Lakish had brought up this whole thing, and also about being flogged, you know, which really indicates that a, you know, you're saying that, you know, he is, you know, he's capable of doing such an act. You're just bringing it up in public, who felt was trifling with the honor of the, you know, of the presidency of the Nasius. Right, no, it wasn't a thing, but it was dealt with the way evidently it was spoken of a Nasi. The tenor evidently was speaking of contemporary things, and it was about being flogged as someone who was, you know, who flouts the authority of the courts and is given a warning and says he doesn't care and is in front of witnesses, and saying it in that manner without, you know, perhaps he felt that it should have been. It should have been qualified. You know, of course, we don't mean we're only speaking theoretically. That it shouldn't somehow touch the honor of the Nasi. He just said it straight out. You know, let's say the Nasi went and did. You know, he spoke in terms. I guess the terms that probably the best parallel would be to what was spoken of President Clinton in this recent campaign.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.